The topic for this morning is higher education, rising costs, what does the future hold? There's already a lot embedded in that because, among other things, I think it embodies the rising costs of operating research universities like this and carrying out the several missions. And there's the costs in the sense of the pricing, the cost to people who attend or otherwise participate in what we do, and how those two do or don't even match up, or what cross-subsidizes what, and so forth. So there's a lot to get into. We have four terrific members of the panel and one traffic cop. I'm Bob Katz. I'm a vice chairman of the board. I've been a trustee for 12 years. I was a graduate of the College of Arts and Sciences in government. Many of you know me as the long time, some might say too long time, head of the annual fund, a job I am now out of, and Paul Salvatore is in, thank God. But I'm also perhaps best known as Margaret Mitchell's straight man. a role I will reprise one more time, I'm told, tomorrow. To my far right is Kent Fox, the provost of the university. I think everyone in the room knows Kent. He is involved on a daily basis in discussions and decisions involving Cornell's revenues and expenses. And before he became provost, he was the Silbert Dean of Engineering here at the Engineering College at Cornell. Michael Lovenheim is an assistant professor in policy analysis and management, also known as PAM. He studies the economics of higher education, focusing on how students make college choices, what factors affect their progression through higher education, the role of individual and institutional resources in driving student higher education outcomes, and the effect of students' post-secondary investment decisions on future labor market outcomes. Rana Glaskell, next to Kent, is an assistant vice president at Stanford, where she has worked for 16 years in the areas of financial aid, budgeting, human resources, accreditation, student learning assessment, and institutional research. As an administrator with an operations research background, Rana has a great interest in measuring the social, educational, and economic aspects of academia, and as I'm sure you all know, Rana is also a trustee of Cornell University. And Ron Ehrenberg is the Irving M. Ives Professor of ILR and Economics, as well as a Stephen H. Weiss Presidential Fellow, and a director of the Cornell Higher Education Research Institute. Ron has been involved in thinking about research and writing about the economics of higher education from the perspectives of a professor, a researcher, a Cornell vice president, a Cornell trustee, and now a trustee of SUNY as well. So having given you those credentials, you will see why I've happily accepted the role of traffic cop and timekeeper. I will try to keep it moving along, but otherwise allow the participants to participate. The way we're going to do this is I'm going to offer each participant an opportunity to say a minute or two of something they would like to throw out on the table on this subject to inform and be part of the conversation. There is an awful lot that one could and in the end would cover if you wrote a fully formed conceptualization or treatise on the subject. As I said, there are the expenses of the university, there are the component expenses of education, research, and impact or outreach, whether they are or should each be self-sustaining, and to what extent are they, or to what extent do different revenue streams cross-subsidize between them, how much of that total revenue needs to be or should be, or currently for that matter is, out of tuition as opposed to out of something else, what the need meeting commitments we have on the financial aid side of tuition means, where they're driving us, where they're going, how we administer them, and whether that's all changing, how much of sticker price tuition that we charge actually drops to the bottom line as revenue, where that's going or has been coming from and is going, and if we're talking about pricing, what I just said was it would be more of a concept of the average, and more kind of biting at the where the rubber meets the road is at the incremental tuition dollar as you increase sticker price, how much of that incremental dollar drops to the bottom line or doesn't, because that's actually a different number. How many people in fact pay sticker price versus something else, where that's trending in numbers and divergence between the continuum of what people actually pay to come here. and whether we have a view as to what that should be, how financial aid is financed, how much of it comes out of tuition as opposed to something else. Do we have a view of what that should be? Do we know where it's trending? Is that a number we are or should be trying to manage? And what about new paradigms of thinking about the expenses of running the place or finding new revenues not currently in place, which could or would change all of these concepts or at least proportionalities going forward? So that's just a bunch of things that occurred to me as I was on an airplane. I'm sure I'm missing some, and there are quite a lot there. My idea here is to ask each of the four participants to do a minute or two on some aspect of those ideas or their own to get some, I don't know what the right metaphor is, but some spokes of the wheel on the table, understanding they're each only going to do a spoke, not their entire philosophy, and then have a conversation among themselves. I'll try to nudge it along, and then somewhere along the line we'll open up the microphones and make it a broader conversation. So with that, Ron, do you want to lead off?
Well, I want to tell you how we got here. I was on budget committees at Cornell since the late 1970s. We always increased tuition by more than prices, and basically that's because we have this goal of being as good as we can on every dimension of our activity. So we have a tremendous quest for resources. Up until the late 70s, we actually had a formal policy at the university of increasing tuition by the amount that median family income went up. And if you have a given set of financial aid policies, and you're basically increasing tuition by about the same amount that median family income is going up, then your financial aid budget will go up by roughly the same amount. But somehow, in the late 70s and going forward, the selective private universities lost their discipline, and they began to think much more about what do we need or what do we want, as opposed to what people can afford. And if you go back to the late 70s, our tuition was about 26% of median family income. Today, as it was pointed out in the opening session, it's more than two-thirds of family income. And so just the notion of increasing tuition by more than family income is going to lead to increasing pressure on financial aid. But if over time you increase the generosity of your financial aid policies, and universities increase the generosity of their financial aid policies, because in periods of prolonged endowment growth, if you have a spending policy which is basically based upon an average of endowment values over a number of years, then you will be spending less out of the current value of the endowment than may seem justifiable. And there was pressure to increase financial aid. And then early in the 21st century, information began to leak out and then become very public on the share of students that were receiving Pell Grants. And it turned out that the selective private universities, in spite of their very generous financial aid policies and their need-blind admission, were not enrolling lots of relatively low-income students. And the institutions felt that that was a problem, and they increased the generosity of their policies even more. And they did this just at a time when the economy collapsed and the need of our students grew. And so you have this situation that need of students is going up, tuition going up by more than median family income, and the income distribution of our students shifting more and more to students who are coming from relatively modest backgrounds. And as a result, the share of our students that receive grant aid keeps going up until we get to the point that we are today, that over half of our students, slightly more than half of our students, are receiving an average of $34,000 in grant aid. And unless we can get to a point where tuition does not go up by more than family incomes are going up, progressively the share of our students that are going to be full-paying students is going to go down and down.
Thanks, Ron. Kent, I'm somewhat alphabetical, I guess.
So I approach this from not the perspective of someone that has a PhD in economics, like our first two panelists down on this end, two actually of the world's leaders in this area, or from the perspective of Stanford and a trustee and an individual who studies this from a research perspective, but as a practitioner. And I think of cost in two ways. I think most of us think of it in from the perspective of what does it cost to come to Cornell as a student. I think about it from the perspective of what does it cost to run the university, because I'm very much involved in figuring out with the rest of the leadership of the university, how can we raise our stature, the quality of this place, and the relative position to our competition in the context of the cost of the institution, whether it's the facilities cost, salary cost, or financial aid cost. So from my perspective, the real burning question is indeed, you know, how do we recruit and get the best students here, but also how do we raise our stature when we have these real costs as an institution? And in many, we have this variety of revenue streams, and not many of them are increasing. They're staying flat, and tuition is just one of those. There are other revenue streams at Cornell as well. But how do we raise our stature in the context of fairly relatively flat net revenue?
Rana?
Yeah, let's get this straight. I'm not a world-leading researcher economist, but I am more like Kent right now. You know, he's a
trustee.
Faculty member, but I have looked at the cost side. How much does it cost to run a university? I've worked on the budget, like Kent has, and I think that my viewpoint is that universities are such wonderful places. The faculty and the students at universities create this infectious intellectual excitement and this ambition and this high quality of expectations. And as people who run universities, I'm an administrator, I want to deliver the highest quality I can to the people who really deserve it, our faculty and our students. But when we look at that, that costs money. Our Dean of Humanities and Sciences at Stanford has said explicitly, I expect the delivery of our administrative services to be commensurate with our standing as a university. And when you have the academic standing of a Cornell or a Stanford, well, that's a pretty high bar to set. And again, that just is gonna cost us some money. So where do we allocate our resources effectively to achieve that goal, to deliver what we should be delivering to our students and to our faculty, while not going crazy and causing the cost of delivering an education to go sky high? So while we still want to strive and achieve and do great new things throughout the university, we have to remember that maybe we should be looking at programs that aren't working. We should always be assessing what we do, from the smallest things to the biggest things. And if something's not working, we should have the courage to get rid of it, to dismantle it. And that's my perspective.
Cool.
Thanks. So I probably know less about Cornell than anyone else in this room. So I'm going to speak instead more broadly about some issues that I think are important broadly in higher education. And in particular, I think one of the biggest challenges that's faced by the higher education system in the United States is how we can give institutions of higher education the resources they need to accommodate the rise in student demand for college education that we've seen. And that's really driven by the shift and the continuing shift of our economy towards more skill-based jobs and industries. And we've seen a large rise in the demand for college, which is kind of proxied by the proportion of students who go to college, of high school graduates who go to college. At the same time, we've seen a pretty precipitous decline in the proportion of those students who actually complete a four-year degree. And this is a huge challenge for the higher education system, that we see these declining completion rates. And it's maybe inappropriate that I'm saying this at Cornell, because it's not a problem that Cornell in particular is facing, or the Cornells of the world. And it's really coming from the lower resource schools, community colleges, less selective public four-year schools. And those are the schools that are soaking up the increased demand, right? So we have increasing numbers of students going to these schools and declining dropout rate or declining completion rates. A lot of the work I've done and some of the work Ron has done has shown that some of the reason behind this seems to be causally related to the low resources these students face when they go to these schools. And so I think from a policy perspective, it's a very important question of how we get these schools the resources they need, particularly in the current political environment, where public funding is not necessarily in vogue, and how we get these schools the resources they need to adequately train the students who are already in the system for the 21st century jobs that we want them to have.
So, do any of you want to follow up with each other?
Well, I think Rania put her finger on a very, very important problem. We want to be the best in everything that we want to do. We want to have the best faculty. We want to have the best quality undergraduate education. We want to have the best support services. We want to have the best facilities. We want to have the best support for research to attract and retain the best faculty. All of these things take money. And as Bob has pointed out, undergraduate tuition streams at the current levels that we are increasing them and at the current rate at which financial aid is taking away resources are not providing a lot of the money. So then the issue basically is, and when I go to sleep each night, I say, boy, am I happy that I'm not a university administrator. How do you make the hard decision about how are we going to trade off all of these different goals, and what are the things that we really value, and what are the things that we're going to let prosper, what are the things that we're going to shrink, and what are the things that we're just going to get rid of? And this is a decision that involves trading off both academic and non-academic and support services, and its decisions, and David Skorton talked about it earlier. How do we generate the revenue streams? And I know the trustees are looking to try to think about what alternative ways are there to generate revenue that will be productive for the university. And it involves deep questions such as how are we going to educate the students in the future? And are there ways that we can use technology or different combinations of faculty to simultaneously reduce the cost of delivering our education, but also increase the quality?
There's a lot of costs that technology brings and alleviates. So technology has two sides. We could probably talk all day about what kind of technology we can use in the classroom, blended learning, flipped classrooms, MOOCs. There's a lot of terms out there. And technology does have the potential to help us reduce costs and bring education to people more cheaply. But in the last 20 years, technology has cost us a tremendous amount. I know it's probably true at Cornell, it's true at most universities, I know it's true at Stanford. There are 1 million hacking attempts at our networks every day. And that means that we have to have this big infrastructure of security, and we have multiple sign-ins and all sorts of stuff, and every once in a while somebody gets through, and that costs us a tremendous amount of money. I think also that we have really high networking costs. There was an article in the New York Times about, I think it was the NYU director of technology, their CIO said he met a student who had 18 mobile devices that he brought to school with him. And he said the average is more like 3. Count up how many you have in this room, and if they were all connected to our wireless network here at Cornell at one time, that creates a tremendous stress on the network, so we have to spend more money for wireless access points. So that is a tremendous cost that we just don't even think about every day. But that's the flip side of the technology, is how much it costs us.
Technology also allows scale. And we at Cornell are pretty unique amongst our peers. We have very few part-time students. We've really not exploited scale beyond the 2,000 students we have. So I think Cornell's engaged in a thought process about should we have more part-time four-credit students? We could do that. Many, many, many of our peers have a lot of students they're reaching apart from those that are on their residential campus. And technology provides that scale advantage.
Ron or Michael, can I ask you to address whether there is subjectively, or looking from above, does it look like there is objectively a theory of tuition setting that relates either to the demographics of your customer base, or the competitive marketplace, if you think of it as a competitive marketplace, or growth in income, or what elements of the university enterprise should or shouldn't pay for themselves as opposed to cross-subsidize other things, research versus education and so forth? Or is it simply, as it sometimes comes out, operationally, we look at what our tuition was last year, we look where everyone else was, we imagine where they're going this year, and we try to stay in the same place.
Do you want me to embarrass the young guy? let me try to do a certain
Thanks, Rob.
Pressure on my, the College Board came out with its annual report within the last few days, and it basically said that over the last 10 years, on average, the net cost of attending higher education institutions has not substantially risen, at least for private nonprofits. And so the real first issue is the confusion in the public eye between the posted price, the tuition level, and what people actually pay. And nationwide, for the private nonprofits, we give back over 40% of our tuition revenue in the form of financial aid. What are the theories about price? I mean, there are absent political pressures. Some people might argue we should raise tuition as high as possible and make those people who could afford to pay it pay as much as possible and give subsidies to all of the others so as not to hold them harmless, and that will generate the most revenue for the university. But politically, that's not going to fly. And so because of that, we get into this uncomfortable position of wanting to stay within the pack. And I will tell you, there were a number of years in the past when Cornell missed or guessed wrongly as to what the pack was going to do, and we raised tuition by less than we actually could have. We are not a high tuition school relative to a number of our private competitors.
Michael? Yeah, I mean, I agree with Ron. There doesn't seem to be a unifying theory of how universities should set prices. And I think there is, we are hamstrung by a couple difficulties. First is it's very hard to know what students are actually paying for college. So this is difficult for researchers because we want to know this. It's difficult for universities know it better, but you don't know the price distribution that students face as well as you might want. It's very difficult for students, especially students that don't have facility with the higher education system and the opaque nature of the pricing scheme. So, you know, I think the any theory of or any pricing system would want to kind of account for, you know, those factors. But I think we're operating, for the most part, in darkness with respect to a lot of these core parameters. That it's very hard to know. You know what to do, to be honest, and it's very hard. I'll just speak from a researcher's perspective as well. It's hard for researchers to know what the universities want to do, right? So, you know, when you think about an optimal pricing scheme, you want to optimize over some kind of objective function, and universities have multiple objectives. And you know, I think meetings like this are where some of those objectives get outlined. But it's hard for the researchers to kind of know what those are, right? Because your tuition scheme would be, if all you want to do is raise the maximum amount of money possible, you do what Ron suggested, right? And you'd eliminate financial aid, perhaps, and just let in rich students, right? But obviously that doesn't accord with the desires of the university. I mean, I agree with that. But so it's you know, there's a balance between, you know, raising money and diversity issues. And it's hard to know what universities are doing, what their preferences are, in order to say what they ought to do. And I think that's holding back, I think, a real rigorous study of that issue.
One way to look at tuition is the impact on students. And we all of us here are part of a university that's just a handful that have need-blind admissions. We have a aid that is need-based. And then thirdly, we meet full need. We don't even have a budget for aid. We will give as much aid as necessary to meet the full need of those students. And so we look at debt, for example, at graduation time. And a Cornell student at graduation time will have had an education where the sticker price is $250,000 at graduation time for all fees, all in costs. And the average student at graduation time will have a debt of $9,000. Of those, and less than half have any debt, and of those that have debt, about 45% have debt, and those have an average about $20,000 in debt. For a $250,000 investment, in their education. I mean, I wish I could buy something for $250,000. I'd have to have more debt than $20,000, at least based on my personal finances. So the impact on the students, 1/6 of our students here have come from families with income of less than $60,000, 1/6. And those students can come to Cornell without any debt. So we're in the stratospheric collection of universities that have financial aid of this type. But still, even at Cornell, it's important.
Yeah, my favorite, Bill Massey, Bill Massey is a higher education researcher, like the folks on my left. And at a conference, I heard him say that the Ivy Leagues and their ilk, Stanford, MIT, were just a pimple on the elephant that is higher education.
Right.
Very attractive pimples.
Numerically,
try to get that out of your mind.
I've had that said.
We love our little pimple. It's okay.
I've had that said to me as well in conferences. Numerically, we're not a rounding error on higher education. The institutions that do it the way we do. When you look at the state systems, when you look at the state systems and so forth, the numbers, we are a lot statistically unimportant as numbers. We think we're far more important for other reasons than sheer numbers. But if I could pick up on two things that were just mentioned. Ron, I believe the number, constant dollars, the actual average price places like us have been charging has stayed pretty much fixed in the $28,000 to $30,000 a year. If you take the number of students, divided into the actual net tuition revenue, look at it over the years, that's about what it's been. I don't think it's even increased at the rate of inflation, perhaps just about the rate of inflation. Kent said we have no financial aid budget, and that's an interesting thing to imagine, particularly when you realize the financial aid budget out of a $2 billion Ithaca enterprise is 20% of it or something like that. It's not a budget because we admit students without regard to financial demographics. And by the way, if you've been reading around the newspapers, even over the last several months, as recently as this week, several institutions that say that is starting to crumble around the edges as to whether they're really doing that.
You're becoming need-aware.
Need-aware at the admissions level. And you have Wesleyan becoming need, blatantly needs non, blatantly increasing the proportion of the class they are going to be taking because they can be fully tuition paying in order to remain need meeting as to the rest. There are a lot of things going around the edges. But the reason we have no budget is the need blind admissions process produces a group with certain financial demographics. We don't take into account in admitting them. At the financial aid side, we then say the only characteristic we take into account in terms of awarding financial aid is the one we paid no attention to in admitting them, which is their financial demographic. And then we have this commitment to meet need, and God knows there are rooms for different people to have different ideas of what need is and what meeting is, but nonetheless, over at least the near term, we've set out there what we think it means, and it operates on itself and produces a number which is really not so much a financial aid number as a how much tuition can this cohort of students pay us. It's a means-based number. Then we have a total amount of tuition we say we need as revenue to operate the place as one of the main streams of revenue, and that and the sticker price then becomes an outcome, in effect, of those two numbers, because if you can get X dollars out of this group and you have to end up with Y dollars total and you have only this other group that's going to pay the sticker price, that tells you what the sticker price is. So you have this specter of very big factors, both in an enterprise way, in a mission way, and at a human level of the people we care about most, which is the student body which we're here about, which one can say is not actually being managed to particular numerical targets. We don't have a view, as far as I know, whether 40% versus 30% versus 20 versus 50% of sticker price tuition going to fund financial aid is either a good idea, a sustainable idea, the idea we embrace and want to stay at, improve, not improve, where we want it to be in 10 years, it just kind of happens to us. And that's the way I see them. That's my non-participant's
comment. Well, let me try to be a little bit provocative, which is to say that the focus on undergraduate tuition and financial aid is just the tip of the iceberg, that our financial models are breaking down, and there are a whole set of issues that university, the start of the 21st century, has to seriously think about. and making some judgments about what appropriate tuition and financial aid policy, that's sort of part of it. But part of it is, I mean, Kent can talk about the comparative study that he did, to the extent that it's public, about you know, what Cornell does relative to other universities and areas where we could expand and generate more revenue. And then there are the whole issues about the course structure, you know, and do we, if we can't afford to be world class in everything, and I'll just give you an example. Before 2008, the way that people looked at administrative side funding was you would do comparative study in an area, and an area would be human. I like to make fun of Mary Opperman, who's a friend of mine. The area would be human resources, and you'd hire a consultant, and the consultant would come back and say, on a per student basis or per staff member basis, you are spending less than the medium of your peer group. And then the administrator would go in to the provost and the president and say, look at all the wonderful things that we could do. We could have retirement counseling and get rid of people like Ehrenberg. We can have employee assistance programs. We can have educational programs to facilitate mobility of students. And yes, we want to be as good as we can in everything, and so we do it. And it was only after the financial meltdown that Cornell and other universities realized, no, we can't do that. And maybe we can't be world-class in administrative functioning. Maybe the things that we should be world-class in are the academic and the student support thing. And the student support thing is very, very important. When the original Pell Grant legislation was passed many years ago, part of the bill, appropriation, called for grants to colleges who were enrolling Pell Grant students because they understood that disadvantaged students economically needed more support to get through. That was never authorized. Maybe it was authorized, but it was never appropriated. And as Cornell moves to attract more students coming from disadvantaged background, the importance of our support services for students increases dramatically.
I'm going to open to questions in a little while, but I'd like to give each of you one more chance to say something rounding out before we do that. Michael, do you want to add any
comments? I'll cede my time to questioning. I think this is a good discussion, so I don't have much to add.
Rana, you want to add something to what you've said so far before we...
Well, one of the things we were going to try and get to today, and maybe some of your questions will be about this, is, you know, where are we going? What's going to happen in the next 10 to 20 years? And I like to quote Yogi Berra, who said, prediction is always difficult, especially when it involves the future. And actually, I don't think Yogi Berra ever said that, but it sounds like something he would say. My viewpoint is that we are going to be tinkering around the edges. We're going to be trying things that will make us more productive, that will lower our costs, but we'll probably also have things that increase our costs. So I think it's going to be a time where we are very conscious of that sticker price that's out there that many of you in the audience are paying. So therefore, we have to be cost conscious, like Ron's paper said. By the way, I work for the Mary Opperman of Stanford, and I showed him that paragraph in your paper. I said, look what it says about HR. And I think that we at Cornell will continue to be that little speck in higher education that can be need blind. I hope we can continue to do that budgetarily. But I think we're in an era where we can't just continue to spend and spend and spend. And that's our challenge as administrators, faculty, and trustees, to make sure that we preserve the Cornell we love for the future.
Kent, any thoughts before the microphone?
Yeah, I just mentioned, even though we're in this amazingly elite, and I would argue important group, there are some common issues we share across the board. For example, one of those is how much our government is going to invest in scholarship and research. I would argue a lot of the nation's economy has been driven by that, and the forecasts for the future don't look good there, and that'll affect all of the very best universities around the country. So there are some issues that we share with, you know, hundreds of really good universities, and others that were pretty distinctive, just the handful we share.
Okay, so we're going to go right, left, right. Could you, is the line slightly longer there? Could you just remind us who you are and your connection to Cornell, where, what school you came out of, and if you could keep it to a question rather than a speech, then I'll say you can also ask a follow-up question after you get a reply.
Certainly. My name is Elia Colon Mala. I'm a graduate of the College of Agriculture and Life Sciences, 88, and the Veterinary School, 92. I'm a veterinary technician educator at SUNY Suffolk. And my question to you is, I understand you see that there is a need and how we're going to meet this need. I want to know what you perceive as what the need is and what are the solutions for meeting that need. My husband teaches at the elementary school level, and he's dealing with the Common Core right now in the area where there's a lot of underserved students, and the behavior and the difficulties and the psychological issues that they face, I see it every day in his face when he comes home with his head hanging low. And I deal with the students that go to Suffolk, and they face various issues as well, and they come from various economic backgrounds, from very, very wealthy to very, very poor. And so as a student that came up at Cornell with many scholarships in the COSET program and the pre-freshman summer program, you know, I'd like to hear what you feel the need is. And I'm a veterinarian, and so I serve on the Vet School Advisory Board, and so there's other things there, like food justice and all those other issues that I see with people that have need.
By need, you mean financial need?
Well, I would say let's step away from financial aid, because that's pretty clear that we need that.
Okay, and is there anyone in particular you want to address it to?
Whoever.
Volunteers.
The diverse groups of students would come in. Well, I'll tell you, I had a student who is a first-generation student from some Latin American country. I don't remember what. And her mother, she was a single parent, and she came to Cornell, and she couldn't eat anything because she wasn't used to the cooking. And then she had roommates who were very, very nice to her, but they were going away each weekend to New York or Toronto, and they're inviting her to come with them, but of course she didn't have the money to come. And then everybody was coming home, going home on fall weekend, fall break, and Thanksgiving. But our financial aid packages only provide money for one trip home a semester. So, but I linked her up with support people in the ILR Office of Student Services, and they arranged places for her to be. And then during fall break and Thanksgiving. And then when I saw her in the spring, when she'd come to New York City for an event that the ILR school put on, she smilingly told me that she was going during spring break to a program in a Latin American country that a religious organization at Cornell was running. And during the summer, she was going to India with a program that the either the college or the university was running. So we dramatically can affect the lives of students of great disadvantage who come here, but there is the support that they need early on. And you see the support at Cornell. We have what is called the EEOP program in the public part and the HEOP program in the private part of the university. And these are programs where students with disadvantage are given a summer to start, and then so that they can take reduced load the first year, and they're guaranteed financial aid for more than 4 years, and there is their sort of support. So basically, academic and student service support for students who are going to have needs that other students may not have.
Sure,
Michael.
I was just going to add something real quick to that, but I think there's also a need. You know, when we think about the issues with sticker price tuition and such, the fact that we have financial aid is fantastic, but I think that there's a general lack of information, particularly among low-income students who are coming from areas where a lot of people don't go to college. There's all this increasing evidence that's coming out that a lot of the low-income, high-ability students going to elite schools come from the cities, right? And it's the student from, you know, rural wherever who you know, the first kid to go to this school in their family, and who, you know, their peers aren't applying to Cornell, right? They might not be aware of the fact that when they see $60,000 of tuition and fees, that totally doesn't apply to them. And in actuality, Cornell is going to be cheaper for them than the state school that, that they might think to go to. And I think there's an information gap that's occurring that's very correlated with socioeconomic status. And I think that the elite schools like Cornell can do, I know there's some that's being done, but I think there's even more that can be done to help alleviate those problems.
Hello. Yes. My name is Regina Little, class of 78, College of Human Ecology, and I have quite a few stickers here. So I've been very involved with Cornell over the years, but the one that I'm most proud of is as a parent. I have a freshman, class of 2017, and so I'd like to shift the conversation because I'm one of those paying sticker price.
Thank you.
Paying full freight.
The provost is
much
you.
To my chagrin. That's what I'm doing. And so, but I don't know. I'm asking the question whether or not you have considered having a conversation with those parents that are paying full freight, only because we have gone through an enormous process, and I can tell you that my peers that are in that same cohort are making decisions not to have their children come to places like Cornell. So it's really, I'm actually shifting the conversation from talking about the lower income to talking about those that are middle class, or maybe we're considered a little above middle class. I don't know what that means, but I do know I'm writing out a full check. And my daughter turned down several full freight scholarships to attend Cornell. And I was very ambivalent about that as well, quite frankly. And I will say that, so there are many parents and children that are saying, I have the money, but do I want to spend the money? And therefore, when I know they can get a great education at another, maybe not Ivy League, but a lead or your university or SUNY or others. And so if you want to get into the top, and we all want to get into the top 10, I think we really have to think about what is it that's really going to make a child or a parent say, you know what, Cornell is worth it. And I haven't really heard that conversation. So as a consultant, you know, what I do or look at the criteria and say, okay, what's going to create the most value? And I think those conversations and those surveys and those kinds of things need to happen in order for us to make a difference.
Let's see if we can get a response to that. Michael, is this your...
When I teach, I teach a class on economics of education that I hope your daughter, you said, takes. So, I always joke with my students that my whole goal in this course is to validate their life choices. And so I'm going to validate your choices too. So Ron's done some seminal work on this. I've done some work on this. I mean, all the evidence we have is in line with there being large returns to college quality in terms of future labor market outcomes, life outcomes. So, you know, whether that means the Cornell versus something like Cornell that's a lot cheaper, but there aren't things that are like Cornell that are a lot cheaper, right, which is part of it. So, there's people on this panel who can do a better job than me at explaining what the information that's being conveyed is. But I do think that what Cornell gives these students in terms of access to researchers, and I'm not just talking about me, I mean the other researchers at Cornell who are doing, you know, groundbreaking work, access to, smaller classes with, you know, in more individualized attention. I did my PhD at Michigan, and you know, the classes there were enormous, right? And we just don't have things like that at Cornell, and I think that has value. And so I think there are real things that students are getting out of it, and I think it's being expressed in how, you know, our students do later in life, but, you know, whether how that's being communicated is another story. So.
But I think you've hit a very fundamental problem. This actually is something that I worry about. If we continue on our current tuition path, will the middle gradually erode, and
exactly.
will we be left with a university
with
of great
yes.
wealth
high
and
low.
Great need,
yep.
and that will be a very unfortunate situation.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I've actually...
I can throw one thought into it, Rana, I've often wondered, since I don't think we do this analysis, so the question is why not, if we are need blind in admissions because we don't think financial wherewithal is a valid or worthwhile indicator of who should be here, then why are we willing to make the place unaffordable for one person to make it affordable for somebody else?
Mm-hmm. And I've done some research at Stanford with parents, and I've done this same survey since the mid-90s every 4 years or so, And it's about the financial stress that the parent experiences. Mm-hmm. And now I think all the Ivy Leagues do the same survey. Those questions have been incorporated into a COFI parent survey, which is done every few years. So if you get it, please fill it out. It talks about how much financial stress you have paying for your part, your parental contribution, whether that's everything or nothing. And have you had to forego certain things in your life because you're paying tuition? Has your student had to forego certain experiences, as our previous questioner elicited a story from Ron? And so we discovered that, yeah, those people right in the middle who just maybe squeaked in a little of financial need or maybe got nothing, applied for it and didn't get it, they were under tremendous stress, much more than the low-income people. So mm-hmm. Stanford responded by changing the formula. And so it started to concentrate more on filling in that gap in the middle. And I think other schools followed suit. And some of the big changes in financial aid that were referred to earlier came about because of this kind of research and an acknowledgement that the middle was getting squeezed out. I think with recent financial crunches that Kent experiences every day, we've eroded a little bit of that and maybe backpedaled a little because it's so expensive to do it. But at least we've made some progress there. The surveys that I've done every 4 years have shown that we've made a little bit of progress on reducing the stress on the middle-income families.
Thank you.
Sir, and can we keep it short to a question?
Sure. Marshall Frank, class of 1961, chemical engineering, 1962. I like to change it from the cost side to the revenue side, and whether you've really considered two other areas for possible increased revenue. One, we want to become a major research university. We're spending a lot of money of doing that. Are we getting a payoff through technology transfer to adequately justify us becoming a major resource university? And the second question is, are we properly utilizing our summer months where we have, let's say, less people here to provide some additional revenue that can come in, maybe going to a year-round university or some other things that could bring in additional revenue? So those are two areas I'd like to see the panel could possibly address.
I think this falls principally in Kent's
sure.
ballpark.
I'll take the first one around research. I would argue that if our primary metric or goal in being one of the world's top research institutions is the payoff from what we discover, the financial payoff, then it's not worth it. It's not worth it. So I've been at Cornell 12 years, and in that 12 years, our research expenditures, almost all of that comes from the outside, primarily federal, has grown from $400 million to $800 million. That includes the medical school. So in 12 years, we've doubled that number. That's revenue that comes in, and then we invest it in the research. The amount of funding that almost every university that gets back from what we'd call patent returns or technology transfer is just a tiny, tiny fraction of that, and at Cornell as well. But if you look at other benefits, if you look at how that those discoveries have changed the world, then you can make, I believe, a profound argument that even though we haven't benefited financially as an institution, we've made an impact in the world. And I would argue that includes not just the sciences, but also the humanities and the social sciences and the arts. And then there's the impact, the primary impact we have are our graduates, our students. There was just a survey last week of over the past 5 years of what are the top 10 universities in terms of the number of companies founded by their alumni worldwide. And Stanford obviously is in that list, but Cornell's in that list. One of the top 10 universities in terms of the number of companies created by graduates. So that's another indicator. But if I was an investor, I would not give a university $10 million because it's going to get back $100 million in research. You do it for other purposes.
Ken, do you want to talk about the throughput question, whether throughput of the plant over the summer, shortening the time to degrees, other ways to reducing the residency requirements, whatever would.
Yep. So we're in the process as we speak, and your second question is incredibly timely. The academic deans, the trustees, the senior leadership of the university, we're looking at ways of diversifying our revenue. We've talked about one quite a bit here, tuition, but there are a lot of others that we have. But there are other opportunities, whether it's the infrastructure, whether it is the intellectual capital of our people here, and we're looking at a lot of those. We really are, and some of those we're going to implement. We haven't decided which ones yet. But we can definitely be more effective in how we use our infrastructure. We have opportunities for even in the way whether we should, you know, sell off some items and then have a third party invest back. There are all kinds of ways that we're in the process of thinking about. And those are the kinds of ways where you can both reduce costs, you can reduce capital investment, and then you can also deploy that in some other way that's more meaningful to the institution. So your second question is really timely, I think, for all universities.
Yep. Thank you. Carol Aslanian, class of 19...
Maybe the last question.
I know. Class of 63, human ecology. I want to switch the conversation or the answer from the selective institutions to the other 95% of students in higher education, which are facing a different problem. For the first year in many years, higher education enrollments have dropped by 500,000, which is not, you know, insignificant. Second, 500 private schools did not meet their enrollment goals. Students are looking more of going right into the workforce, taking on shorter term certificate programs. They're even going overseas where they're finding higher education at a more reasonable rate. Do we risk the problem, do we risk the situation that we will not have the educated society that we need so badly to keep up with times because we're outpricing the marketplace?
Well, Carol, I think you, of course, have hit a major you've hit a major social problem that our nation is facing, and you know, for the purpose of this discussion, the interesting question would be how will Cornell respond to the social issues, and I think that part of it is with sort of the notion of technology. And basically, to be able to expand what we do to a much broader population, but at the same time, preserving the high quality of what we have here. I mean, as a trustee of the SUNY system, I fear for the future of public higher education, and I fear for the future of the smaller, underfunded colleges and the implications of that for the nation. But I also fear that the solutions to those problems and the policies which the Obama administration are beginning to sort of talk about may also have adverse effects on what is going on here.
I'll get the last question. If anybody does, with the crystal ball, do any of you see the upward march of sticker price tuition, maybe with fewer and fewer people paying it? See something fundamental that's really going to bend that curve so that 10 years from now, we won't simply be further down the same spiral we're on. Either because politically the pricing power will go away, the expense model will change dramatically, other revenue sources will appear to displace tuition or something, or actual external funding of financial aid will arrive.
I think from a national perspective, there will be new ventures that will fill the gaps in this price structure. They may be online, they may be from for-profit colleges. The big growth in the U.S. has been in the for-profit area. I think, I probably have my number wrong, but I think there are like 1,000 higher ed for-profit entities now. And not all of them are great. Some are filling real needs. But I do believe one of our great opportunities we've had, or advantages in America, has been we have a whole spectrum of some 4,000 higher ed entities. And because we're entrepreneurial as a nation, I'm confident there'll be higher ed programs that will be at the right sticker price for individuals. They may not be the most elite of the universities. There may be something they give up in the area of facilities or individual contact, but I'm confident there'll be opportunities, the whole price spectrum.
Anybody else want a last word? If not, I think we're all due at lunches with the deans at 11:30. And thank you very much.